Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers. I guess it's only Paul is here.
Yeah, I'm the only one here.
But thank you anyway for having me at this wonderful place. It's really nice here, coming from rainy Vancouver. So whether you believe that the Earth was colonized by extraterrestrial life, or you believe that, you know, life originated on this planet, independent of that belief, it's pretty clear that at the beginning there was, you know, life was much, much less diverse than it is now. And so, maybe it's, I guess this is about microbes. If you, you know, if you pick up a handful of rich soil, you have more microbes in there. There are stars in the universe, I believe, something like that. And of course, they're not all different, but so they have. So my one of my favorite examples is this. Well, at least it's kind of fading. But about, I think about 2 years ago in Science, they had this paper about microbial flora on your hands. And on each one of your hands, you have about 400 species of microbes, and you have different species on the two hands. Now, there's some overlap, but they're not the same. So it's not the same community. So that's quite a lot if you think, and that's, you know, after you wash your hands. So anyway, I mean, my point is there's a lot of diversity, and it somehow evolved from much less diversity. So the question is how. Okay, so one example, famous example for what they call an adaptive radiation, the cichlids in the African lakes thought to have evolved in within between 500,000 years and 2 million years from a single ancestor. And those are, used to be anyway, thousands of species. So that's a lot of diversity in a relatively short period of time. Question is, how did it happen? These are very big lakes, but still. Now,
and can you try to mate random fish against each other? It just doesn't work anymore, or what?
Yeah, mostly it doesn't work. Sometimes it does. It's not so. So maybe I should say I'm not going to talk about species concepts. So actually, I'm going to say what I mean now by diversity. When we classify species, mostly, of course, now we use a lot of genetic tools, but traditionally, and I guess still a lot of people take that approach, what we do is we go out and measure phenotypes, length, weight, color, morphology, and then we basically make, so we record the data and then we make a histogram in this phenotype space. Something like this. And if in this histogram we see different peaks, we basically say, okay, now we have different, at least different forms. We don't necessarily have to call them different species, but different morphs. And often, of course, we identify them as different species. So these different fishes would occupy these different peaks. So the question of diversification becomes the following. You start off with one species, which is one peak, and you want to end up with many species, i.e. with many peaks, and that is a question formally and kind of roughly speaking, that's a question of pattern formation in phenotype space. So you start off with a unimodal distribution and you wonder what are the processes that yield multimodal distributions over time in this phenotype space. So that's one way of framing this problem of understanding diversification. And here's the traditional explanation that you're all familiar with, or at least most of you, which is the following. You have a unimodal distribution and you take a sample of that peak and put it into different environments. Let's say different islands for argument's sake. And on each one of these islands you have different climatic conditions, different communities, different ranges, and so on, and therefore different selection pressures. So each one of those samples from this single peak evolves into a different direction. And over time, they just become different species. So that's the classical explanation of this pattern formation. And I mean, yeah, to some extent, it's this is the main explanation that at least up until recently that we had for speciation. So this is what I think would still most people, most evolution biologists, think how speciation works or diversification works. And I have just a quote here from two famous people, basically saying that the splitting itself is not the Darwinian process. So for the splitting, the initial splitting here is given by some, basically some geographical process, where it can't work without a geographical component. And in some sense, that's a little, almost on a philosophical level, that's a little weird to have. Basically, for the core problem in evolutionary biology, you don't have an evolutionary explanation in some sense, or at least you need a geographical explanation. So anyway, what I call adaptive speciation or adaptive diversification is the opposite process, where pattern formation occurs not in isolation, but because they're not in isolation. So in other words, a process that requires isolation, ecological interactions that drive this pattern formation. And I guess that's what I'm going to talk about. First, I want to give you an empirical example of diversification without isolation, and then I want to talk about two different theoretical approaches to study this pattern formation, and in the end I want to say something about some recent work that we did. And I should say here, this most recent work in some circuitous way came actually from my previous visit at KITP, because this was done with together with Slava Ispolatov. And he used to be a postdoc with Sergei Maslov, who was here, and that made the connection. Anyway, so an empirical example, that's from E. coli. What we did was the usual thing, we took Rich Lenski's strain and evolved them in some serial batch culture, as they call it. So what you do is you inoculate, you put a small sample into what they call a virgin environment, you let it grow for a day, they use up the resources, then you take a small sample of this stationary population and inoculate it again, and so on. The dilution here is 1 in 100, that gives you about 7 generations a day, and you do this, say, for, 6 months, and then you have 1,000 generations. And what we did was we evolved that the environment that we gave them was a mixture of two carbon sources, glucose and acetate. But they are well mixed in the sense that they evolve, they live in this flask in an incubator, and it shakes all the time. All these 1,000 generations. So E. coli are great in some sense and not so great in other senses. For example, it's fairly hard to phenotype them. At least we found that. So, but one thing you can do is you can plate them this environment here is not the environment that they evolve in. That's some different environment. So that's like, taking a fish and drying it out and weighing it. But that weight is also not experienced by the fish in some sense. But anyway, so one phenotype that you can look at is the colony size on such plates. And this is the ancestor, and then when we plated out the population after 1,000 generations, this is what we saw. Now we have two types. And so this seems to be heritable, in other words, if you take this guy and grow it up and then plate it out again, it is again small, and same for the large ones. So that was our basic diversification event. And of course, then we wanted to know what's happening.
Doesn't all replica experiments appear the same small and large type?
Yeah. So we have.
And is it comparable in size, like between the different?
Well, I think they do, yeah. So they usually we run these populations in tenfold replicate populations, and they basically all show the same pattern.
You were not expecting this, I guess, right?
Well, to tell you the truth, we didn't know what we expect.
But did you look at many phenotypes and this is what you found? Or?
No, that's the first one we looked at because that's what you usually do.
So you're very lucky. Or
yeah, or maybe it's just very common.
I think it would be very common to find different colony.
I think colony morphology is
which doesn't mean that they're the same clones, right? They could be different clones and have the same similar phenotypes in this plate.
That's right.
Right. So
right.
There could be even more diversity that you're not seeing.
Yeah.
Right? So the big colonies, they could be different, but
yeah, they could still have different properties. Yeah. But I mean, it is true in some sense. I mean, they could have not shown any, for that same reason, they could be dimorphic or polymorphic without showing any colony dimorphism.
Yeah,
but here, each colony, the mixture, you don't find this in the Ebola populations. You don't find a mixture, right?
Sorry?
So those are, it's a mixture of different independently Ebola populations. Or do you find that the populations are polymorphic for the SNL?
So each evolving population is polymorphic.
Oh, okay.
So this is what happens in one single population. So that's why I say this is not geographic isolation. This is within the population, this evolves.
So you think it's neutral variation?
Or? No. I think there's a reason. So.
The colony size here is a binary phenotype. It's large or small, or can it be?
Well, no. It's a distribution with two peaks, basically.
So can one reproducibly observe different growth rates? So, right, on your previous picture already, one sees very tiny colony and a small but not so tiny one.
Yeah.
So when you say that it's heritable, is it? Heritable in an analog sense.
We haven't tested that.
Okay.
Partly because we are not so interested in that phenotype. Because this is a phenotype that they exhibit on some rich medium plates. That is not the environment that they evolve in.
And the red color is intrinsic, or is it a stain? Or
no, that's a
Photoshop.
That's a color that they develop when they grow on a particular sugar.
I see.
That's just for visualization purposes.
Okay. Great.
Okay. So it is really growth rate that distinguishes the two, or is it? So if you take sort of a few out from one of the colonies and maybe compete them with a few from the other colony, is it sort of predictable?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to go too much into this, but yeah, it turns out that these large and small colonies, these are two types that can coexist because of their ecological properties. That's a long story short, so to speak.
But the size is like a marker.
Yeah.
Okay.
But okay, let me go a little bit further, and then it becomes less of a marker. So what happens when these guys grow in this mixture of glucose and acetate is they have this dioxic growth phase, growth pattern, which is they first grow on glucose because that's for them the richer resource. It's more ATP in the glucose. But then the glucose is gone because they're in this batch. There's no incoming glucose. At least, for a while. So then they start using the acetate, so more or less. And so basically what we think is happening is that these two strains deal differently with this dioxic growth. In other words, one is a bit worse at glucose, but better at acetate, and vice versa. And so now we're going to go to phenotypes that are more related to the evolution environment, which is you just have them in this batch culture, but it's still not exactly the same because it's the same environment, but they are in isolation now. So they're not together. So this is what they look like, and the picture shows that they have different growth profiles. And as I said, this is just a kind of an example that I want to, like, I mean, I could say more about these things and, you know, give you data about growth rate on glucose, growth rate on acetate, and so on, but...
And different lines here correspond to what?
Sorry?
Different lines correspond to what?
Different small colonies? Yeah. So basically what you do is you take a small colony, you grow it up, and then you put that into one of these batches in a well, in a 96 well plate reader, and then you measure the growth rate. And then you measure the density over time.
I'm sorry, so all of these lines are progeny of one particular small colony?
No, you do that many times.
Which is different small colonies of the same plant.
That's right. Yeah.
Is there an identifiable lag phase on the right?
So that's something you could measure, one can measure from these
curves. Plateau, but I just had saying a trivial point. I just don't see a plateau in the curves on the right.
Yeah. It still takes a
that's what you would call lag.
Yeah.
That does it very fast.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's then true that under your evolution, they both are neutral, but they are not neutral on the plate.
Sorry?
Like, on the plate, one is fitter than the other because it makes larger colonies.
Well,
but in your evolution experiment, the final outcome in the stationary phase is the same, so they are neutral?
No, they're not. They're definitely not neutral. I mean, on the plates, we don't really compete them because they never even touch. So that's just a phenotype. We don't check whether.
Right, but there are more cells in the larger colony.
I guess there would be.
Or it's flatter.
Yeah. But I mean, in the evolution environment, they're definitely not neutral, because they can coexist. And yeah, maybe I should have included a slide. I mean, you can take a population of these guys, the large ones, and put a small number of small ones in there, and then the small ones go up in frequency. So if you do invasion experiments, so this would be time, this would be frequency, then it looks something like this. So this is a frequency of L.
So there's frequency dependent selection then?
Yeah.
So, sorry, what do those three lines mean?
That's the frequency over time, frequency of L. So let's say, in this case, small invades, in this case, large invades.
But from looking at these plots, it seems like the small one is always better. It seems to grow better on glucose.
But remember, though, this is when they grow alone.
Yeah. Okay.
So when they grow, together, then the thing looks different.
So when you have a sweep during your adaptation experiment,
yeah,
then you have only one type left, right? If you had a, because I mean, you did all the evolution experiment, and then you find us at the end of it. But if you would have looked at your population at the time you had a sweep, then you would have lost one type.
Well, so at some point there starts to be coexistence. So there's no sweep anymore in that sense. So it's not just one type there.
You can get soft sweeps that have non-bulk backgrounds. If the mutation rate is high.
A bit later on, I'll show you some more data that maybe, help a little bit with this question. Anyway, so we also try to understand now then, you know, what the genetic and physiological basis is, and then it becomes a little complicated, but we have an advantage because we are dealing with the carbohydrate metabolism. And basically, the way I think of this, which is probably, you know, fairly wrong, but it helps me anyway, is a system of pipes. You let in glucose, and then it can go. So to get in more glucose, you have to get rid of the byproducts of glycolysis. And there's a fast way of doing this and a slow way of doing this. The fast way of just acetate secretion, and the slow way is going through the TCA cycle. This is a more efficient way. So if you have all the time in the world, this is what you would like to do. But of course, if you're competing, you don't have all the time in the world. And basically what we think is that the two the two types, small and large, that coexist are one type does this and the other type does this. We did some microarray expression analysis, and that's basically what we find when we compare the small ones and the large ones versus the ancestor. Is that the large ones, these are the glucose specialists, and they overexpress this acetate pathway, whereas the small ones overexpress the TCA cycle compared to the ancestor.
So this is the ancestor is the one that Rich Lenski froze down 25 years ago? Or?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, maybe it's a little unsatisfactory, but I just wanted to, you know, I basically just wanted you to listen to me for this one and believe me what I say, but I guess that's not the case. But so this is an example for us, an example where two types evolved out of one in a well-mixed population. Without any, at least, you know, I'm always a bit, in principle, hesitant to say it's not a structured population, because these things are so tiny, and compared to the wild they live in, they're so tiny that I don't know what kind of structure there is, but at least it's definitely not two different islands or something like that.
And neither species sticks to the wall, the flask, or, you know, you could imagine they had different stickiness.
No. So it's very different from the Pseudomonas experiments in that sense.
And of course, in a batch transfer protocol, it wouldn't matter if you stuck, because you wouldn't get transferred.
Right.
Right.
That's true. Yeah.
We don't ever get stickiness automatically.
In some sense, yeah. And we don't ever see stuff sticking to the. To the walls or anything like that.
Can I ask? So for this experiment, did you also look at the phenotype in time? How it changed? Can you see the branching?
Yeah, good question. And that's the slide that I was referring to.
Okay.
That will come later.
Okay.
In a little while. Anyway, so yeah. Anyway, so now I want to go into the theory. So adaptive diversification, basically what you need is to sit on a fitness minimum, and then your distribution can do this, maybe. And there are two basic theoretical problems associated with that. First of all, why should you ever sit on a fitness minimum? Because that seems like a knife-edge situation. Because if you don't sit on a fitness minimum and you evolve, you just evolve up the fitness landscape. Second problem is, even if you do sit on a fitness minimum, if you have random mating, you can't escape from that fitness minimum. So that's what I call the ecological and the population genetic problem of diversification or speciation. And I'm mostly or maybe depending on time, exclusively going to talk about the first one. Of these problems.
When you say minimum, you probably mean a saddle point. I mean, it can be a minimum in one direction and a maximum in 17,000 others. It's enough for you that one direction.
Yeah, and that's actually a very important point that I'll come back to as well later when I look at high-dimensional phenotype space. So here is the basic model for a biologist's model for basically speciation, because these are, you know, maybe Darwin's finches, and they vary in many aspects, but for example, they vary in mate traits, but particularly they vary in beak size, and because they vary in beak size, they eat different foods, different seeds. And so now we make a thought experiment, which is basically a stochastic model that we actually did. So it's a bit more, it's a bit more than a thought experiment. But there are basically two ingredients to understand, to determine the. So what you're interested in is the evolution of this peak size, and there are two determinants of this. One is the distribution of seed sizes, seeds of different sizes. The other is competitive impact. As you can imagine, these birds have much less impact on these birds than these birds do on themselves. Because these guys eat completely different stuff than these guys. Whereas two blue ones eat the same food, so they impact each other much more. So the other ingredient, one ingredient is the seed abundance curve, the other ingredient is the competitive impact function as a function of phenotypic distance. So if you put that into, so these are the two functions. Now you make a stochastic model as follows. You have a bunch of individuals, each one of them is given by it by a real number, which is the beak size. Each one of them, all individuals have the same birth rate, so they give birth at the same rate, but they have different death rates. And these two things now, these two determinants, determine the death rate of individuals. The green curve, the seed abundance curve, makes it so that if you have a phenotype for which there are more seeds, your death rate goes down because it's in the denominator here, because you have more seeds. On the other hand, if you have a rare phenotype, then this sum here is going to be small because you're going to sum over all the other individuals, over the competitive impact from all the other individuals, but because you are rare, most of them are different from you, and therefore this competitive impact will be small. Whereas if you're a common phenotype, your death rate will be higher because most of the people in the population are eating the same food as you are. So these are the two determinants. And now so each individual now has a birth rate and an associated death rate. Now you can crank a stochastic model. And the only further assumption that you need is you need some mutations. So when individuals give birth, their offspring has essentially the same phenotype as the parent, except if a small mutation occurs. And that drives, well, that's the raw material for evolution, and then you can just let it go. So you have a blob of individuals. At each point in time is some distribution, and that distribution somehow wanders around in phenotype space. So what happens? Well, first, so here's is the blob at any given time. First, what happens is that the population evolves to the maximum of the green curve, of the resource abundance curve. Now when they are there, two things can happen, and what happens then depends on the relative width of these two functions. The way to understand that is, imagine everyone is exactly at the maximum of the resource curve. Now imagine a mutant comes along. That mutant has a disadvantage because its resource abundance is smaller, because it's now here, but it has an advantage because it feels less of a competitive impact. Now if the disadvantage is bigger than the advantage, in other words, if this curve falls off more steeply than this one, then this mutant cannot invade, that the one that is slightly different from everybody else who is sitting here. And then what that means is that this is basically the end point of the evolutionary process. Of course, you'll have some variation because of mutation, but basically the blob stays here. On the other hand, if the advantage of being different is bigger than the disadvantage of having a lower resource abundance, then what you get is evolutionary branching. And that's this kind of paradigmatic process that is, well, it's a paradigm for adaptive diversification. So for diversification without geographic isolation. In fact, you need ecological contact for this process of diversification. Without contact, that doesn't work, because you need this frequency dependence. And so this is the solution to this first problem, basically, that I mentioned, which is, why do you ever sit on a fitness minimum? What happens is, The population starts out sitting to the left of a fitness minimum, so it moves up this branch. So the direction here is in this direction. So it sits here. The selection gradient is basically points that way, so it moves that way. And because fitness is frequency dependent, the fitness profile changes as the population evolves, and what happens is it catches up, the minimum catches up with the population. So that when it comes to sit on the maximum of the abundance curve, it actually sits on the fitness minimum, and then you get this diversification. Of course, here we don't have to, this is an asexual birth process, because I just assumed that the individuals give birth to offspring with the same phenotype, and so therefore this invasion of mutants on either side of this maximum leads to this branching.
And the approximate symmetry of the two branches is just an artifact of the fairly simple model?
Yeah, exactly.
This would be population size dependent, the balance, right? Because
population size dependent.
Population size. So you were talking like about these two curvatures.
Yeah, it is. So
expected in large population is always going to be more into the branching mode.
So can you
control whether you branch or not by varying population size?
I mean, if you have very small populations, then first of all the branches would have a higher probability of going extinct, and also the selection profile at the minimum is not very sharp, because you don't have a very sharp peak. And actually, I'm not 100% sure, but I actually think there is an optimal population size if you, in terms of speed of branching, like waiting time for this process. Because I don't remember how it works actually, but if population size is too big, then I guess it takes longer just to numerically, so to speak, to reach the large numbers for the branches. I'm not 100% sure, but I think Ulf Diekmann actually did some stuff about this, and I think they found an optimal population size.
When you come from small, they would first be comfortable on one peak, and at some point... When you come from small population size,
yeah,
then they would first be comfortable on one peak, and then at some point.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So, a related question. I'm guessing it's going to be relatively insensitive to population size, because you've got the resource in the denominator of the death rate, right?
Yeah.
And the competition in the numerator. So, it's the ratio of those two. But if you put the resource in the birth rate instead, would that change these results? Would it be more dependent on population size?
I don't know.
It should be fairly equivalent.
That's a good question, actually.
It's just the ratio of those two terms, and population size doesn't come into it so much.
I don't know. Could be explored. But anyway, so here's the deterministic analog of this, where population size doesn't matter. So this whole the experiments, you know, they came after we did this, because we wanted to somehow see whether this actually happens, and all of this in some form or another has its roots in the work of Hans Metz, whom some of you may know, because he is the inventor of this framework called adaptive dynamics. And I just want to very quickly go through it on the basis of this example. So here, and what you do is you start with an ecological model and with a monomorphic population. So we still keep this beak size or body size in mind. This is the ecological dynamics of a monomorphic population for a particular body size x. Now, of course, the equilibrium of this would be k of x. So this is just a logistic equation. So if everybody in the population has phenotype X, they just go to the equilibrium K of X. Now, what happens if a mutant comes along? What is its population dynamics? Well, it's also a logistic equation. And here I assume that the growth rate is just one. It's also a logistic equation, but the density dependent term is as follows. Well, if the mutant is rare, it doesn't feel its own density. So its own density is not there. It does feel the residence density, so the type that is there, which is k of x, but it only feels it by a discounted amount. The discounting factor is this competitive impact, alpha. So that's what is usually called the effective density that is experienced by the mutant, and it is scaled by the mutant's resource abundance. And so this term, this is the population dynamics, the ecological dynamics of a rare mutant in a resident population that is at X, and that the resident population is at equilibrium. And this is the per capita growth rate, and that's what's called the invasion fitness. So the per capita growth rate of a rare mutant in a given monomorphic resident that is at equilibrium. This notion can be extended to non-equilibrium dynamics and so on, but the important thing is that this is a fitness definition, unlike the ones that we have seen yesterday, for example, that is explicitly ecological in nature, so to speak. So this is a per capita growth rate, and not just some number S.
There should be some n dependence there, no?
N of x is equal to k of x.
Yeah.
Ah, that's okay.
So the resident is here.
Okay.
Because I assume that the resident is at its equilibrium.
Yes. Okay. And this is during the initial transient invasion. Eventually, if the mutant were 50% of the population, we'd have to change.
Right. So this is only to determine the initial fate of mutants.
Why is it the product of, I don't understand why it's the product of those two terms. It's kind of, that's like a discounting effect, I guess, right?
Right.
I would have just summed the two densities, I guess.
Which two densities?
Of the X and Y type, right?
That's so the density of the Y type would be there,
yeah.
But it isn't because it's assumed to be very small. Because it's only when the mutant is rare. This is only the initial invasion attempt, so to speak. So if the mutant becomes, I mean, in this equation here, if the mutant becomes non-rare, so to speak, then you would have to add, well, first of all, then the resident may not be at equilibrium anymore. So then you would have to put nx here, and you would have to add ny in the denominator here. So this is a simplifying assumption.
Ny in the numerator.
Sorry?
In the numerator. You'd have to add n of y in the numerator.
Yeah. Isn't that called the denominator?
No, the denominator is the bottom part.
No, the denominator.
Oh.
That's just like
denominator.
Isn't it called a
numerator?
A denominator? Sorry.
And then the growth rate, however, of the mutant is just the same as the wild type that it's invading, right? So that's a simplification. I mean, in your previous equation, or even in this one, both growth rates, both linear growth rates are one. Is that how realistic is that?
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Well, so this is the actual growth rate. This is the birth rate. That's just an assumption.
What I meant to say is that the birth rates are the same. That's,
yeah. So this is just, I mean, you know, going back to your question, I don't know your name, but, you know, one could, of course, have the phenotype also affect the birth rate.
But you have chosen not to.
I have chosen not to.
And it turns out that this is actually a little bit of, that's actually special, right? I mean, that if you look at more general models, the picture actually changes?
As far as I know, it changes in some sense, but it doesn't change in the sense that you would get a different catalog of regimes.
Mm-hmm.
So
here the alpha over k, so the alpha x minus y over k, that term, that ratio,
mm-hmm.
would be whether or not that's higher than one or lower than one. is again whether or not the one curve is steeper than the other curve, right?
Yeah, you have to take that into account too. I mean, basically what you want to know whether this is whether this is bigger or smaller than zero. See, for so for if y is x, in other words, if the mutant type is the same as the resident type, then this is one, because alpha x, you know, alpha zero is one, and then you have one minus kx over kx, and that's zero. But as it should be, because the resident is in equilibrium, so its growth rate is zero.
Yes.
And so all you want to know basically is whether this thing is bigger or smaller than zero. If it is bigger than zero, then the mutant can invade.
Yes, but this is the same as in your last, where you were asking whether the curve, the one curve is super,
right,
the other one,
well,
that determines.
Almost, because that is, so first you have to wait until you're at the maximum.
Yeah.
To ask, you see, okay, let me just go on maybe, then it will become clear. So what you do now is you have this, in this is a fitness function. Now what you want to know is which y's are good and which y's are bad, so to speak. In other words, in which direction does evolution take y? So what you do is you just take the partial derivative with respect to the mutant. So you have, so this is, well, I guess maybe, well, here. So here is your x, and basically, you know, here, fitness function is zero here. Basically, what you want to know is it like this or like this?
An alpha of x minus y is something you drew as a Gaussian, and how?
Yeah, it's usually, you could think of it as a Gaussian.
Why would it be Gaussian and not something skewed or?
Yeah. But I mean, so far it doesn't have to be anything. I mean, it's just some.
Has to be positive.
Yeah, it has to be positive. And you can always scale it so that it's 1 at 0.
1 at 0, and you expect it to go down as you go up.
But actually, you know, it could be so you can have asymmetric competition so that it actually isn't the maximum at 0. Anyway, if you calculate this here, you will see that alpha doesn't actually play a role in this particular case.
So greater than zero, isn't it?
Sorry?
Because you've assumed it's symmetric, it's flat
to
zero.
Let's see, if you take the derivative, yeah, exactly, because it's as a maximum at zero. So if you take the derivative with respect to y and evaluate it at x, you get this. So all that matters, as long as you are away from the maximum, all that matters is this resource abundance. That corresponds to this initial movement towards the maximum. So, and of course, if this is your selection gradient, then your k is a potential for this process. So, of course, you end up at the maximum of k. So wait, sorry, oops. So this is usually called the selection gradient. And then the adaptive dynamics is simply this, simply a constant of proportionality times the selection gradient. And this constant here has to do with the mutational process. And in higher dimensional phenotype spaces, this is not a constant anymore, it's a matrix. And anyway, in general, this actually depends on X as well, because it depends on population size, mutation production. But for one dimensional phenotypes like this, basically this can be rescaled to one. And so the selection gradient gives you the dynamics of your phenotype, and as I just said, of course, here it's just a potential. I mean, then you have a differential equation for x. You look for equilibria, and then you can determine the stability of these equilibria based on this differential equation. That's what's called convergence stability. And the trick here is that there's another kind of stability, which is evolution stability. So on the one hand, we have convergence stability, which is just referring to this differential equation here. But on the other hand, so now we have this equilibrium, it's stable, but now we can ask, okay, at this equilibrium, is that also evolutionarily stable? In other words, what's the second derivative of the fitness function doing there? We know the first derivative is zero, because D is the first derivative, and that's zero at the equilibrium by definition. So what's the second derivative? And that's now where this, these considerations come in. The second derivative now of the fitness function has the second derivative of this competition term. So basically what we have is, we have this term in the second derivative of the fitness function, we have this term and this term. This term is the same as the stability condition for convergence of the differential equation. And I mean, so I'm pointing this out to show that these two conditions, so for convergence stability, we need this to be smaller than zero. For evolutionary stability, we need this to be smaller than zero. And these are two different conditions in general. So it's possible to have one satisfied but not the other. It's possible, as we in this case, this is satisfied, but now you see that if sigma alpha is small enough, in other words, if this red curve is narrow enough, this is going to be positive here. And then what happens is that the blue term essentially is responsible for this converging to the maximum, and the red term here is responsible for the divergence at this term. And basically, the interesting thing is actually, there in one dimension, there's only these two possible cases. You either have convergence to a fitness maximum, or convergence to a fitness minimum. Of course, you could also have just divergence to the boundary of phenotype space or something like this. But if you have an interior equilibrium, they have to be one of these. So this, what this means is that this convergence to a fitness minimum is a generic process.
In one dimension, but in reality, the dimensions are much higher.
That's right. And what I'll say at the end, although, yeah, I may not get to it, is that in higher dimensions, it's even more generic. It happens almost inevitably because of these saddle points. Because in higher dimensions, you will almost invariably find at least one dimension where
direction is going to be unstable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but even in one dimension, there's basically, you know, half the cases have to be this divergence. And that's part of the reason why, you know, why I personally think, while I think that, you know, the judgment is of course still out of, well, you know, how common this process is in reality, but there's no, in theory, I would say, it's, you know, this basic obstacle that people didn't understand why you would ever be on the fitness minimum, I think that has now been removed for quite a while.
What's the role of mutations here? So we haven't specifically modeled mutations.
Yeah, so.
You just asked if I have a variant with it invade or not.
So it will,
invade or not.
Yeah.
But you could have mutations that bias you sort of away from that minimum.
Yeah.
They tend to push you to the right.
Yeah, so basically, the mutational process would be included here. And in general, you know, this could be a complicated process, I guess.
Okay.
And could affect, say, the stability. So, if it's just a constant here, then the equilibrium is simply given by the zeros of the selection gradient. But if, you know, if this has some complicated form, then the equilibrium points might be something else, mm-hmm. And that might be then what you have in mind, maybe that they have some sort of biased process. Mm-hmm. So anyway, let's quickly go back to this experiment. So this is the situation. And
okay. Back to the thing about the intermediate population size.
Yeah.
So if the population size is too small, no density effects, so then you don't get the divergence, right?
Right.
If the population size is too big, then you go maybe to the equilibrium solution of just a Gaussian Gaussian phenotype distribution, and you don't get the splitting up.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and that has been a bone of contention for some years, because that is true. I think what you say is true for the Gaussian model. So if these two, but it may not be true for other.
I don't think it is. So that's how this is kind of special.
It's not generic. The Gaussian case, exactly. So I plan to say something about that too. Anyway. In a little while. So let's go back to this is the situation. So now what I would like to do is, or what we wanted to do is, you know, basically say that this was evolutionary branching.
Okay, sorry, but here the resource distribution is not.
Yeah.
Is not any model, right?
No. But I mean, you know, you could. Basically, you have a bimodal resource distribution, and. But in some sense, you could still think that, you know, the way they use these resources, that there is some intermediate maximum. So it is, you know, it is true that this is not exactly the situation, and maybe it's very far from the situation of the model. Nevertheless, what we wanted to do is, so that is, first of all, half diversification in sympatry without isolation, and then see whether some salient features of this evolutionary branching process are satisfied. And by salient features is, for example, well, salient features, I mean, basically evolutionary branching is characterized by a process of directional selection and then a splitting event, so to speak.
So you think a fitness, not resource, but fitness based on resource distribution could be in any model?
Right.
Okay.
Could be. Yeah. But even if it isn't, we could still have these salient features, so that you have some sort of directional selection and then the splitting. So, for example, in this expression analysis that we did, is we saw that some genetic changes are common to both large and small compared to the ancestor. So they're both common to both lineages, and those are actually the majority, and then some of the changes distinguish between large and small. And then some, at least that doesn't contradict this directional phase of evolution and then the splitting. So it means that the splitting didn't happen right away. So in other words, some genetic changes whether they were necessary or not is another question, but at least they occurred before the splitting happened. So that, in some sense, at least doesn't contradict this picture. And finally, here's the graph. So, for example, we took this acetate lag as a phenotype, and we just measured populations at different points in time. And then it looks like evolutionary branching. I mean, there's some sort of directional phase here, and then there is a splitting, but it's not symmetric, for example. And that may be because it doesn't have these symmetry properties, the system. So at least that looks like evolutionary branching. Now, the other thing is that if in evolutionary branching, the propensity to diversify becomes bigger over time, because you first need to approach the branching point. And that's something we can also test by taking these three populations, which are all non-diversified, and take single clones and restart the evolution experiment to come somewhere and see whether how primed these clones are to produce diversification. And what we see is that indeed these guys, single clones from this population, are more likely to diversify in a restarted evolution experiments than single clones from here and from here.
That is in a fixed amount of time.
That's in a fixed amount of time. I forget. That's in less time. That's maybe 200 generations or something.
Okay.
So how often do you actually observe diversification? If there's only a small probability of actually getting diversification from the ancestral derived, it looks like 20%.
Yeah, but that's only a short period of time. That's not the whole 1,000 generations. That's only, I think, 200 generations.
Okay, I see. So, but 200 are not enough. I mean, from this left graph, you wouldn't expect the A population to be diversified after 200
That's
generations.
That's right. But I mean, you know, it is probably a stochastic process, at least at some level.
Do you have an idea how often this generally occurs, like the left case? Like, have you?
Well, so we haven't done this assay, which is quite labor intensive for all the other. But I mean, we do see this colony, the dimorphism based on the colony. We do see that in every replicate after 1,000 generations.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it always takes about 500 generations to die.
We don't know that.
Oh, because you only look at the
end. We only look at the end. I mean, this, you know, this is one great thing about the evolution of E. coli or evolution experiments. You have a fossil record, but nevertheless, it always takes time to go back and exactly determine when it happened and so on.
And if you take the strains, say, at 1,000 generations,
mm-hmm.
you compete them to the ancestor,
mm-hmm.
you should not see that frequency dependent.
No. We did that. I mean, we also did things like, you know, take these and re-diversify them. So we did a number of things. I think if we compete them against the ancestor, they just win. Both of them.
Oh, because they're always better than the ancestor.
Yeah, because they evolved, you know. Even if they hadn't diversified, they would be better. Although it is possible. So this, the large one is more like the ancestor. So I would bet this guy over as I compete the ancestor. It is possible that this small one.
Well, the large one is actually the bottom one, right? That has the.
No, the large one is the one with the long lag.
Yeah.
So it's possible that the small one, which we call the fast switcher, can coexist with the ancestor, but nevertheless, it's. I don't even know. See, in my. Because I'm so ingrained in this adaptive dynamics mutant resident, I don't even think these fitness assays, where you do an evolution experiment for 1,000 generations and then you do a fitness assay against the ancestor, I don't think that tells you anything. Because they never compete against the ancestor while they're evolving. You know, these 1,000, that's like competing, I don't know, an elephant against a mammoth, or something, I don't know. But anyway, sometimes I think, like, you know, it tells you, it's like a phenotypic assay, but it doesn't really tell you about the evolution. Anyway, so for those reasons, we kind of, we published this, and in the title we didn't even have evolutionary branching. But now I would say, in my mind, just for my private purposes, this is an example of evolutionary branching. Okay, so now I want to go into this other approach, which touches on these Gaussian questions. So adaptive dynamics basically is on one end of the spectrum. In some assumptions, it assumes extreme rarity of mutations. So if a resident and a mutant. But you could also just model, if you go back to the very beginning, the whole distribution in which maybe, at least in a deterministic partial differential equation, you have all types present at all times. But that's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. And then ask what happens. And so there is, you know, the PDE analog of this logistic equation is basically very easy to write down. You just have this convolution here, where you have the current distribution, and you take this convolution, and that gives you the effective density at a phenotype X. Again, this effective density is going to be smaller as a trend if X is rare, and it's going to be higher if X is common, and otherwise you have the same structure here. And so now you see immediately that the solution a solution satisfies this in some sense. It's kind of, it's a bit superficial, but anyway, if you have a function phi hat, a distribution phi hat that satisfies this, you have a solution. And so now,
this is without mutation, you start with all phenotypes then.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a good point. I mean, one could easily, of course, not of course, but one could easily introduce a mutation kernel here and so on, but we just start with all phenotypes present. So now let's assume that these two functions are actually Gaussian functions, the red and the green one. Then we have, before we had a kind of a phase transition or two different regimes where you have either it's the maximum of the carrying capacity is the evolutionary endpoint, or you get this divergence. Now we also have a phase transition, but it's a different kind, which is, yeah?
Are you assuming then that there's a distribution in the genotype that drives the phenotype distribution?
Good question. So we assume, and that's actually, yeah. So we assume that basically genotype is phenotype for these purposes. But in principle, one could have an intermediate distribution where the genotype gives a certain phenotype distribution, and that determines then the ecological drivers. Anyway, so if it's again a question of the magnitude of these curvatures, if sigma alpha is bigger than sigma k, then basically the solution is a delta function which corresponds to this optimum at the carrying capacity. I mean, the population being stuck at the optimum of the carrying capacity. If this condition is satisfied, then the solution is a Gaussian, because that's this thing, this non-genericity of Gaussians. For Gaussians, you always have a Gaussian as a solution to this convolution equation, to this, if k and alpha are Gaussian, this has a Gaussian solution with a positive variance if this condition is satisfied. So that's not divergent, that's not pattern formation.
Now I get back to David's question. I don't quite understand now, especially that they have a phenotype distribution. Shouldn't there be a fitness distribution? And shouldn't there be sort of Fisher theorem acting on the diversity?
Well, so
are we assuming that the distribution is generated by mutation selection balance, so it is static?
It's basically just the distribution is generated by asexual reproduction. So we have a distribution of types over X. Each X gives birth at a certain rate to another X and dies at certain rates. And these rates are given by the ecological model here.
So that has a fitness in it, the term that's multiplying to 5X, and that Gaussian distribution of phenotypes is exactly the one that gives everyone the same fitness.
That's right.
Add that equilibrium to zero variance to the Fisher's theorem applies.
And but as we already mentioned, this always takes a little while. This result is basically non-generic, because if you take other functions, like slightly non-Gaussian ones, or actually in this case it's more than slightly non-Gaussian ones, then this same model gives you pattern formation. And in fact, you can go, you can look for parameter spaces and all the epsilons and deltas that give you pattern formation. This is the Gaussian case right here, and all these other cases give you pattern formation. So again, pattern formation is generic in this model. And so I have to, if I had time, I would say some more about, so in this model, I was mentioning you could include mutations, but you can also include sexual reproduction and assortative mating, but I want to quickly go. And the interesting thing is that if you introduce sexual reproduction and assortative mating, you get pattern formation even in the Gaussian case. Anyway, so let me just recall this situation here. So this is the PDE model. We have these two determinants. Basically, what's happening is that if sigma alpha is smaller than sigma k, we go from this distribution on the left to a distribution with a positive variance in the Gaussian case, or to a multimodal distribution in the generic case. But anyway, the condition is this. So it's a basically a condition on the width of these two functions. So now I ask the question, if we have, so this is just one phenotype, one scalar phenotype body size. If we have multiple phenotypes, what happens? Let's say two phenotypes. Now we have a carrying capacity function that depends on two dimensions. And this is what I call the separable case. Now, instead of a Gaussian, it's just a bivariate, a univariate Gaussian, it's a bivariate Gaussian, so the isoclines are circles here. Now, but this is, of course, a very special case. In the general or more general cases, you multiply a third term here, and that is what I call an interaction between phenotypes. In other words, if the two phenotypic dimensions don't determine this carrying capacity multiplicatively in this way, but there's an interaction between the two phenotypes. So, for example, if you have microbes that produce different substances, then the gain in carrying capacity might not just be the product of the gain in carrying capacity from each substance alone.
Why not just change phenotypic coordinates?
What's that?
Why not change phenotypic coordinates?
Well, that's the basis of the story. But anyway, what you see here is now we have ellipses as isoclines instead of circles. And what you do is when you have an ellipse is one axis gets shorter, the other axis gets longer. And it doesn't matter, by the way, whether this sigma k 1-2 is positive or negative, or what kind of interaction it is, as long as there is one. If this is for a negative, if it's positive, it's just the other way around. So in particular, you find now, if you have this non-separable case of with phenotype interactions, you get suddenly one direction where this width of the carrying capacity becomes bigger. So now, how does that play out if you have, well, if we look at these conditions for diversification, let's say that's our starting point, which is kind of right at the boundary of diversification. So in each phenotypic direction separately, we have sigma alpha 1-1 is sigma k 1-1 and sigma alpha, 2-2 is sigma k 2-2. So we are in each, if we were to consider each phenotypic dimension alone, we would be right on the boundary of this diversification event. Now assume we have some interaction between the two phenotypic components in determining the carrying capacity. And now we take it, so now we have this picture, but now we can take, instead of the usual basis, we take this basis, and that doesn't matter here because that's radially symmetric, so we still get the same widths. And now we see that in these new coordinates, we have one direction where the condition is not satisfied now robustly, so to speak, but we have another direction in which the condition is now satisfied. So the only thing we did was we introduced this interaction term. And again, it doesn't matter what kind of interaction you have. The only thing that matters is that it's there. And lo and behold, you get one direction where the condition is satisfied. That's when you start out with right at the boundary. But that's the general principle, basically. And so, yeah, don't worry about this, but I just put that up. This is actually something that you can, you know, it's fairly easy to show. The basic thing is, the basic statement is about matrices, and I think that's extremely well known in physics. If you take a diagonal matrix, then of course the diagonal elements are all the eigenvalues, and you can order them, and then there's a certain range of these eigenvalues. Now if you put some off-diagonal elements and diagonalize that new matrix, then the range of these the eigenvalues has increased. That's a basic fact about matrices. And if you use that fact to compare those two matrices that give you quadratic forms for these functions k and alpha, then what it translates to is that if you start with a situation where you have a separable case, so each of these matrices is diagonal, and let's say you are at the knife edge situation where they are the same, the two matrices are exactly the same, and then put in any kind of off-diagonal elements, you will find one direction, one composite direction, where the diversification condition is now satisfied. That's basically what this means. So for example, this is a case where we start out with dimension m is the variable, but in each dimension, sigma alpha is bigger than sigma k, so there's no diversification. And then we start adding the sigma kij, which are large because they are in the denominator, in the denominator. This interaction term is actually small. And then we look at, so and then we inject random off-diagonal, well, we inject those random off-diagonal elements, and we check, you know, we do this many times for any given m, and we check each time whether there is a, the one composite direction where the diversification condition is satisfied, and as you see, as the dimension increases, there will always be one dimension where you get a minimum.
Because we're in this weird non-generic Gaussian case, diversification here just means a Gaussian distribution of phenotypes.
Right, but so, and yeah, but you, so basically this generalizes to non-Gaussian cases as well, at least that's what our numerical results indicate.
But your use of the Gaussian is somehow justified by a law of large numbers and
no.
Adding up many independent things, it's just mathematically easier to get started.
See, that, I mean, this is a, it's a funny thing, I think, it's a mixture of those two things is the reason why the Gaussian is used so much. For example, I think, you know, it's kind of twisted in the sense that I think part of the reason why the Gaussian is used is because the convolution equation does have a solution. Yes. But that's also the reason why that makes it non-generic.
Yes.
And so it's kind of, but I mean, you know, we, yeah. Anyway, for the diversification condition, there, it doesn't matter whether it's Gaussian or non-Gaussian. In some rough sense. So this happens also for non-Gaussian cases. And this is, you know, so this is the work that I did with this Bolotov, and the starting point with this was my only connection to the theme of this week, which is spatial structure, because we, many years ago, we did some, we took this model with one phenotypic dimension, but put it in a spatial arena and with a gradient so that the optimum of the phenotype, the optimum of the carrying capacity varied with spatial dimension. And we always wondered, and then we showed in that paper that diversification becomes much easier in such a system. And we never quite understood until we did this why this happens, because assuming this gradient that the optimum of the carrying capacity changes with spatial location is exactly the same as assuming an interaction between the phenotypic and the spatial dimension. And that's why it becomes easier. Anyway, so I guess my first point was here that this diversification or evolutionary branching is a generic process. We got some empirical support, or at least what I would call empirical support, from these microbial evolution experiments. Contrary to what some people claimed in the literature, I actually think that adaptive dynamics and PDE models, even though they are in some sense at different ends of the spectrum, yield very compatible results. And the final point, and that's, so this is actually something that I think is potentially interesting, just because. So this thing about the phenotypic dimension, what it means is that if you want to look for phenotypes that are under disruptive selection, maybe one would have to consider composite phenotypes. So if you have, you know, different axes, maybe the direction along which you get disruptive selection is some composite is not one of those axes, but a composite, a linear combination of those axes. And when I think about diversity, say in the microbial world, or even in viruses, I can imagine that this may actually be an important consideration. Anyway, you can read more about this in an upcoming book that I have in Princeton University Press. Thank you very much.
Ask a question now. To explain those fish in that African lake, you need not just two species, you need lots. And so do you have a sense of, can you do this hierarchically? Can you get branches and the branches split and the branches split? Is there some simple way of thinking about that? And you need high dimensions to get this hierarchy of saddle points?
So I think high dimension makes it easier. So that's another thing that I didn't show, but you can also, for example, measure or plot the number of directions you find disruptive selection as a function of the dimension of phenotype space, and that also goes up. So the more phenotypes you consider, the more ways you will get to split. But there's also, even in the one-dimensional case, there is of course, or not of course, but there is sequential branching. So for example, there's something that is not proven, but that I think is true. In the Gaussian case, what will happen is that it's gonna branch and branch and branch and branch. So because that's the connection between, so to speak, the adaptive dynamics and the PDE model. In the adaptive dynamics, you're one-dimensional, you go to the branching point, you get two branches. Then these go to some equilibrium, they branch again, and so on. And that, in the Gaussian case, that goes on until they basically fill up all the phenotype space. And that's the same as in the PDE model for the Gaussian case. Whereas in other models, let's say if the carrying capacity is quadratic, you can usually have it that it stops after one branching. So basically, you can have everything between two and infinitely many. So.
How about the case when you have the species will be themselves changing the resource distribution, right? So do you think for having, you know, over a certain number of diversification, you need this change of the resource abundance to generate new resource landscapes?
Yeah, so I mean, what can I say? Yeah, that's a very valid question. And so we have done some modeling of the resource, looked at models of diversification or evolution of this one-dimensional phenotype where the resource has itself a dynamic. In this case, you know, the resource is just given by this K of X and doesn't move. But you could also assume that the resource has a dynamic, and that actually affects things quite a bit. And then, of course, you could, you can do that in more dimensions as well.
Sorry, that would mean coevolution. Yeah.
Then you would have coevolution, yeah.
Because the resource does change, right? I mean, in your case. I mean, they eat the seeds and then there's no seeds of that.
Well, but the availability of seeds, Kx, is always the same. So it's basically
But if you compete with many, you have less.
Yeah, it's implicit.
That's right.
But it doesn't evolve.
And one could have an explicit ecological dynamic for the resource as well.
If you call that resource the number of susceptible individuals, you just get back to the theory of evolution.
Yeah.
Did Sewell Wright cover all this? Once upon a time, I'm surprised you don't mention him because it's so reminiscent of what he did. You don't get Gaussians. Also, why haven't you sequenced your bacteria?
We have. We just haven't gotten around to.
Come on.
It's true.
There's a ton of information there in the genomics that I would be mining if I was you. I think it's really important.
Anyway, so yeah, see. Yeah, I take your point about sequencing, and maybe it's a matter of resources too. But anyway, But sewer, right, I mean, coming in so as I did from the side and from the horizontally into this field has advantages and disadvantages. One of the disadvantages that I don't know the literature that well, but my impression is anyway that most of his thinking was about static fitness landscapes. And how do you get from one, so you have a fitness landscape, how do you go from one peak to the next?
Yes, right, correct.
And this is all about non-static landscapes.
Okay.
That's the whole point, basically.
The static means fixed in time, or?
Yeah, static in time. So you, so basically you have some landscape given and you have different peaks. And the question is if a population, the classical question, as far as I understand it, is if you have a population sitting in one peak.
How do you get from peak to peak?
How do you get from peak to peak? So then you have to, you know, basically small populations and so on.
If you're climbing up and you get to a saddle point, half the population goes up one mountain, half the population goes up another. And it's surprising he didn't talk about that.
But Wright viewed it as a distribution of genomes over the landscape. There's a network of genomes. So you're viewing it as a single guy moving around. That's not what Wright was talking about. You really should read his paper.
But wouldn't you agree that Wright was mainly talking about fixed fitness landscape?
I agree. I think you're right there. Yeah.
So what would happen with models if you did vary the probability of having an offspring? If the linear term was variable.
Sorry, if the
if there was a variable frequency independent interaction. Right now, all the fitness variability is frequency dependent, right? Is a non-linear term.
So there's so the fitness is basically, there's a frequency-dependent component, which is this competitive impact, and there's a frequency-independent component, which is the carrying capacity. I mean, so how much...
The carrying capacity only matters if there's other guys to compete with you. If there's no density, then you're carrying, everyone doesn't matter the different types of different carrying
right.
At the low density limit, everyone's the same fitness.
At low density, yeah, there's no fitness difference.
And what I'm asking is, but suppose there is...
Yeah, so there have been, you know, there have been variants of this model, for example, by Eva Krishni, who, these people, so she looked at basically when the birth rate is affected by the phenotype. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, all I can say is that they also find branching. But based on my general slide, you know, with the fitness landscape, I'm moving to optimum or minimum. That's not so surprising.
I guess the reason I'm asking this, so you're saying that Gaussian non-generic, so you have to get away from the Gaussian, and I'm wondering if you can recover a generic case just by fiddling with
the
linear term.
Yeah, that works.
The point is that
it's generic. You get
generic. Yeah.
So in the evolution in this experiment. Do you have an idea whether this adaptive diversification is in some sense reversible? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, it's a lot debated about incipient speciation and so on. So in the context of this experiment, one could either imagine that you can sort of go back to something similar to the ancestors, to say if you reduce the population size or something, or that subsequent compensatory mutations have made that part. Do you have any sort of idea how reversible this is?
But why would you go back? I mean, you would lose one type.
Well, or go to something close to the ancestor, or... I'm thinking here of the, you know, say this is a branching process.
Mm-hmm.
And how far is this, would that be reversible?
So that they would both evolve back to the middle somehow.
But if it's driven by this competition,
yeah.
And see, then for example, reducing the population size decreases again, sort of one in the middle should again be more favorable. On the other hand, if you have something compensatory mutations that would make that path irreversible, then that, that wouldn't happen. Rather, one would die out, for example. Or, so I wonder whether.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so one thing is, you know, because of these. I mean, they evolved for many hundreds of generations in the presence of each other, so to speak. So that environment is completely different, in some sense, for both of them than the ancestral environment, or whatever the environment of the ancestors. So I'm not sure there would be any need for them to become like the ancestor anymore. There will be, yeah, so I'm not quite sure how to answer that question, but what we did do is, for example, you can take the endpoints and just restart an evolution experiment and see whether, you know, it branches again. Basically, if it were branching, what you would expect is that it goes again to the branching point, and what happens is that the large colonies, the slow switches, they do that, but the small ones don't. So the small ones, they somehow, they're kind of stuck at being small, and we think that's because they, to get this TCA cycle going, even while you're growing on glucose, you have to destroy some regulatory mechanism that is not so easy to rebuild again. So that's, I don't know how to answer that question, but that's the only thing that I can say right now.
Okay.